There's probably nobody who has struggled as long and hard against water fluoridation as Paul Connett of the Fluoride Action Network. Today, I'm pleased to have him on my show. I'm David Crowe, your host for The Infectious Myth. Before we start our discussion on water fluoridation, I want to remind you that you can contact me by email at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join our Facebook community at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at @infectiousmyth. Thanks for being a listener and supporter. If you'd like to support in other ways, please contact me. My guest today, Paul Connett, is a graduate of Cambridge University and has a PhD in chemistry from Dartmouth College. He taught chemistry and toxicology for 23 years at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York, retiring in 2006 as a full professor. He helped found the Fluoride Action Network, FAN, and is director of the American Environmental Health Studies Project. He wrote the book The Zero Waste Solution in 2013. He also co-authored The Case Against Fluoride, How Hazardous Waste Ended Up in Our Drinking Water, and the Bad Science and Powerful Politics That Keeps It There, along with Dr. James Beck and Spedding Micklem in 2010. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you to be on your show again.
Yes. Yeah, it's good to have you. I think the last time I talked to you was about 10 years ago, so hopefully we get a little bit of an update on what's been happening. A lot, I think.
Yes.
So can you briefly describe how fluoridation developed, the fluoridation of water developed as an idea that fluoridation is a good thing that we should put in our water supply?
Well, yes, indeed. In the beginning of the 20th century, a dentist noticed that Mackay noticed that there were very strange markings on children's teeth, particularly in Colorado and Texas. Brown stain, mm-hmm. and puzzled over what caused this. By 1931, they found out it was fluoride in the water that was causing this stain. And at that time, it was called dental mottling. Mm-hmm. But when they found out that it was caused by fluoride, they changed the name to dental fluorosis. Now, what Mackay did, he observed that even though these teeth looked ghastly, there was less tooth decay with those children who had this discoloration of the enamel, mottling of the enamel. So that was the birth of the idea that perhaps there was a level of fluoride that would reduce tooth decay without causing too much dental fluorosis.
Right.
And they finally hit on the level that about one part per million would do the trick. However, there may have been other reasons why the children with dental fluorosis had less tooth decay. And that's because in the 20s, there were companies selling tooth powders designed to remove this stain. Now, I'm sure it wasn't too effective, but what people did, this is before the invention of the toothbrush.
Right.
And what they would do is to take a rag, dip it into this powder, and furiously rub on their teeth. Now, it may not have removed much of the staining, but what it would have done was to remove some of the bacteria and the plaque,
right,
and so on that caused tooth decay.
Right.
And of course, the kids who didn't have the staining were not using this powder to do that. So the people with the dental fluorosis had the benefit of getting rid of some of the bacteria that caused tooth decay.
Yeah.
That's it's a hypothesis.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting one.
Yeah, and I guess also, well, the problem about studying communities is that communities don't just differ in the level of water fluoridation, but the diet in communities that are more rural or more urban will vary dramatically too, which also has a big impact on tooth decay.
Absolutely. It's one of the problems that's dogged this whole issue for years. There's so many factors, so many confounding factors in terms of what causes tooth decay. You know, but sunshine can make a difference. The level of sunshine, because sunshine makes a vitamin D, and vitamin D is very important for the development of the teeth and so on.
Yes, yes, and obviously the modern diet with highly refined, a lot of sugar, things like that is obviously awful for teeth. So, industries benefited from water fluoridation because fluoridation was a major pollutant and people were starting to think that fluoride was a really bad thing. So what were the industries that were producing fluoride as a waste?
Yes, that is a good point. In fact, just to underline that fact, the Department of Agriculture said in the late 1930s that fluoride had caused more damage to agriculture than any other air pollutant, and certain industries were facing lawsuits from farmers at that time. One of the big companies was the aluminum industry. Mm-hmm. They used a huge amount of fluoride in their processing of aluminum, and obviously lots of emissions into the environment. They would have been concerned not only about lawsuits from farmers, but lawsuits from their own workers, and for the damage, the health damage they were getting. The workers in the aluminum pot lines would have been exposed to a lot of fluoride.
Mm-hmm. And so, go ahead, continue.
Yeah, well, one of the concerns that the aluminum industry had, and in fact, it was one of the aluminum, the chief chemist for Alcoa, Churchill, who was one of the three studies that found that identified fluoride is causing dental fluorosis, who was very concerned about that. And one of the things he did in 1931 was to contact people in, dentists, in fact, in Messina, where there was a big Alcoa plant, to see if the children had dental fluorosis. And they did in the area. They had dental fluorosis. And also how much fluoride was in the water. And there wasn't much fluoride in the water. And, that was terrible news for Churchill.
Right,
because it meant that, you know, kids were getting dental fluorosis, presumably from the emissions from the aluminum plant. And nothing is worse for an industry to have a telltale biomarker of exposure to a pollutant, which also caused other problems and could be very devastating in a lawsuit.
Right. So what did he do about this information? Was it covered up?
Well, what we know is that there seem to have been two respectable strands in this whole thing. The U.S. Public Health Service continued to do the research sparked by Mackay's findings. And in particular, H. Treadley Dean of the U.S. Public Health Service went down and documented all the areas with dental fluorosis and proceeded to examine tooth decay. And eventually, in about 1942, he came through with the 21-city study, which purported to show that there was an inverse relationship between the level of fluoride in the water and tooth decay. As the fluoride at the level of the water went up, tooth decay went down until about one part per million. And then above one part per million, you start to see the rates of dental fluorosis climb steeply. Hence, one part per million became the optimal level for the water.
Right.
Okay. So that was the respectable line. But meanwhile, chemists at the Mellon Institute in Pittsburgh, which is closely related to the Mellon family and the aluminum industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Gerald Cox who said, I think we should stop this idea of reducing the levels of fluoride in the water and consider actually adding fluoride to the water. That was in 1939. And clearly that was industrially motivated,
right.
The notion of not having to lower the fluoride levels in the drinking water too low and, in fact, add fluoride to the water. Clearly, industrially.
Right. And what did you, one of the first problems about water fluoridation I became aware of was the fact that when you add it to water, it's not like giving people a specific dose every day.
No,
it varies dramatically. People vary dramatically in how much water they drink. So,
absolutely. Well, here again, you've hit the nail on the head. This practice should never have started. You should never, ever use the public water supply to deliver medicine or human treatment, however you're going to describe it. But you shouldn't because, A, as you said, you can't control the dose. Because you can't control how much water people drink. You can't control who it goes to. Once you put it in the water, it goes to everybody.
Right.
It goes to babies, goes to infants, goes to elderly people, it goes to sick people, it goes to people with poor kidney function who can't get rid of the fluoride as efficiently as others. It goes to people with borderline iodine deficiency. Right. And on top of all that, you're violating the individual's right to informed consent for medication.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, what you're doing is you're allowing a community to do to everyone what a doctor is not allowed to do to anyone. A doctor cannot force you to take a medication. He could advise you to take it. He can't force you to take it. And so this is the beginning, then, of forced medication. And to underline that this was a very unusual thing to do and a reckless thing to do in my mind is we've never, ever done it with any other form of medical treatment. We have never used the water supply, other than fluoride, to deliver any kind of human treatment, medicine, to a population. Yes, we add a lot of chemicals to the water, but those chemicals are added to the water to make the water safe to drink. You're treating the water.
Right, so like chlorination would be at a specific level to kill the bacteria, and the amount is for the water. It's not for the people drinking
it. Absolutely correct.
Yes. So in the industries that were using fluoride, what were some of the bigger types of health effects that were being found, apart from dental fluorosis?
Well, one of the things they were finding in the aluminum industry was it was affecting the connective tissue to the bones. I've met aluminum workers who cannot lift their arms above their shoulder line. So they're getting stiffness in those ligaments and so on. So I think that was pretty obvious. I've actually seen workers with exotosis.
Exotosis?
It's a bone growth, bone spurs.
Okay.
So I think it was pretty obvious that the workers were being hurt by fluoride.
And in there are places in the world, like you mentioned Colorado, and I believe also in China, maybe in India, where there are naturally high levels of fluoride in the water. And what kinds of health problems do people deal with in those places?
Yes, there are literally millions of people in the world that have had their lives ruined by fluoride, mainly in India and China, parts of Africa, the Middle East, and Mexico. What you see, of course, with the kids, you see dental fluorosis, but in the same villages where you see the dental fluorosis, you will see skeletal fluorosis in the adults. It's a continuum. It's they usually use just one word, fluorosis, that areas are endemic for fluorosis.
Right.
They don't distinguish because they know that if they see dental fluorosis in their kids, they're going to see skeletal fluorosis in the adults. And the first symptoms that those people experience who eventually get full-blown skeletal fluorosis is pains in the joints, stiffness in the joints, pains in the joints. And those symptoms are identical to the first symptoms of arthritis. So you have to ask the question, how many people, of the millions of people that get arthritis, particularly in the United States, Canada, and the other fluoridated countries, how many of those have their condition either caused by fluoride or exacerbated by fluoride? And, of course, we don't know because none of the fluoridated countries are performing any tests, any studies to see if there's a relationship between arthritis rates and how long you've lived in a fluoridated
country. And how much water you drink, which would influence
that.
the dose. So I've seen in China old people who are very shrunken and bent over. Would that be perhaps an outcome of water of natural high fluoridation levels?
Yes, almost certainly, almost certainly. I have been to China, been to villages which have this condition, and it's heartbreaking. You see these people absolutely doubled over.
Mm-hmm.
Can't leave their houses. Can't get out of bed. It's pretty awful.
Yes. So water fluoridation started mainly in the United States, and is it still true that the U.S. is the most enthusiastic fluoridator of water?
More people are drinking fluoridated water in North America, which includes both Canada and the United States, than the rest of the world put together. So whilst our populations, or at least the American population, sees this as the norm, everybody is doing it, and the promoters always use this fact. You know, if they're talking to a city, a large city, which is not fluoridated, oh, you're the odd one out. You're against progress. You're
right.
Not looking after your kids, and we're all put on a guilt trip if we don't fluoridate. But
right.
If you look around the world, for example, 97% of the European population is not drinking fluoridated water.
Mm-hmm.
There are only three countries in Europe, certainly Western Europe, that fluoridate. One is England at 10%. One is Spain at about 11%. And, of course, Ireland, which has mandatory fluoridation, has had it since 1963. They have about 73% of their population drinking fluoridated water. The rest of Europe is not fluoridated. Some countries started, like the Netherlands, and stopped. Some countries had one town fluoridated, like Germany, Sweden, Finland, but they've all stopped.
Okay. And what's happening in the United States? I mean, there's continuing struggles. I know the city of Calgary put in fluoridation and then took it out again. What's happening in North America in terms of these struggles? Is it increasing or decreasing?
We have, since about 2010, we've had 157 communities in many of them in Canada, a number in the United States, and one or two in New Zealand, and quite a number in Australia when Queensland lifted mandatory fluoridation. And most recently, Israel banned fluoridation. In August of this year, Israel,
okay.
The Minister of Health of Israel, banned fluoridation completely. So that's a lot of people. So we're getting up to about 9 million people now have been liberated from fluoridation in the last 4 or 5 years, which is very, very exciting. Calgary was a very exciting moment. As you, I'm sure you know, James Beck, one of my co-authors,
mm-hmm.
MD, PhD, he helped to get fluoride out of Calgary and used the book. Every councillor got a copy of our book, The Case Against Fluoride.
Okay.
And that, I think that helped them to make that decision.
Yeah, it was interesting in Calgary because I live here just coincidentally, but the fluoridation was put in with a plebiscite, but they had several plebiscites in Calgary, and it was always about 50-50 because, you know, I don't really think the average person really knew that much, and there was a lot of publicly funded propaganda pro-fluoridation, so eventually they got a slight victory in terms of the plebiscite, but it was not taken out by plebiscite. It was taken out by the city councillors themselves.
Yeah. And very wisely, too. I mean, the council said words to the effect, we are not medically trained. We are not scientists. We do not feel that we can make this decision to force medicine on people that don't want it. And don't bother us with lots of science because we just cannot resolve that. What we know is that we cannot, in all conscience, force people to drink this stuff. And I think that was a very, very wise decision.
Right, and that's about 1 million people who
went
from fluoridated to non-fluoridated.
Well, we've had other victories in Canada. Quebec City stopped. In Ontario, Waterloo, fluoridation made its Waterloo in Ontario. Windsor stopped. Dryden stopped. Quite a number of communities. And also we're seeing the beginnings of a lawsuit in the Peel region. Citizens there, Lisa Cianciello, have hired one of the largest law firms in Canada. And they prepared a brief. They went to the region of Peel and said, look, before we go to court, we want you to see this. This is a brief that we've drawn up. This brief shows that essentially fluoridation is a violation of the Canadian Constitution. The Supreme Court in Canada, is it Supreme Court or Superior? What do they call
Supreme
it?
Supreme Court.
Yeah. They ruled in, I think it was 1953, that the government couldn't medicate individuals against their will.
Okay.
And that has never been overturned, that ruling. And some people thought it had. Some people thought that the Fluoridation Act superseded that ruling by the Supreme Court. But this brief said no, it does not supersede the restraints of the Constitution. And so, and also they said that the council had legal liabilities for this, that they, if they continued without due diligence and continued to fluoridate, they would be subject to legal action from anybody that was harmed. And so that the council dodged the bullet. They said that they gave it to their legal department and said, well, please tell us if you agree with this brief or not. Come back to us in a month's time. Well, they came back to them in a month's time in September of this year. And the council said, well, we won't make a decision now. They didn't report that the legal team did not. They didn't make that public.
Right.
They said, we're not going to do anything now. We're going to wait till after the election. Typical political cowardice. But and that's when immediately the citizen said, to hell with you, we've given you the chance, now we're gonna launch this lawsuit, see you in court.
Wow.
So that's where we are. And if they win, or even if they don't win, actually, the very fact that if this goes to court, if it's accepted as a legitimate case, then the other side will have to produce experts.
Right.
The very experts which are telling that the medical officers of health in particular, who get paid a lot of money and are employed by local councils to make judgments on local health issues,
right,
if they go to court and are cross-examined under oath, they're going to be seen to have feet of clay.
Right,
right now what is happening is that they are essentially following policy, that the policy of Health Canada is pro-fluoridation. It's there.
Yes.
They support the practice.
Mm-hmm.
And they require their ministers of health to support policy. And so I'm afraid these automatons, these clockwork toys, go in front of councillors and tell them just how wonderful fluoridation is, how it is safe and effective and efficient, all these things. Now, they're not giving, in my view, I mean, this is my opinion, they're not giving independent judgments. They're not giving opinions based upon their professional research of the literature.
Right.
And I've tried to get these guys to debate me. Not one of them throughout Canada is prepared to debate me. So right now they're getting away with it because the councillors are impressed with their authority, etc. But once those guys are in court and they have to answer questions like, well, have you read these studies which indicate that fluoride damages the brain? Have you seen, read these studies that fluoride lowers IQ? Did you know there's 48 of those studies and 41 of them shows a lowering of IQ? No. Have you read any of those studies? Well, maybe one or two. So what studies have you read which that have made you believe that you can ignore all this evidence that fluoridation may be lowering the IQ of our children? They won't have any answers.
Yes. I mean, one of the points about fluoridation is that even if it's strengthened the teeth, it's a systemic medication, and so that doesn't mean that it doesn't have side effects in other parts of the body. So at the very best, it would be a cost-benefit trade-off.
Yeah, exactly. And fluoridation should have ended. As I said before, it should never have started. It's a lousy medical practice. But it should have ended in 1999 when the chief proponent of fluoridation in the United States, the Oral Health Division, which works hand in glove with the American Dental Association promoting fluoridation, when they admitted in 1999 that the predominant benefit of fluoride was topical, not systemic, admitting that they'd got the mechanism of fluoridation wrong, because as you probably know, pediatricians were giving pregnant women tablets and babies drops before their teeth had erupted.
Right.
The idea that the fluoride will build up in the enamel under the gums, so
right,
when they erupted, they'd be more resistant to the acid attack from bacteria.
Right.
But they said, whoops, no, we're wrong. And then not enough fluoride actually does accumulate in the enamel before eruption to protect against tooth decay. And so the predominant benefit is topical. Well, the moment they admitted that, it should have ended fluoridation, because obviously, if it's topical, fluoridated toothpaste is universally available. All you have to do is to brush it on your teeth and spit it out. And this does two things. One, it avoids a lot of exposure to all the other tissues in the body, because you're just focusing on the teeth and you're spitting it out. And secondly, you're not forcing it on people that don't want it if you put your efforts into encouraging more people to brush their teeth with fluoridated toothpaste.
Right. I don't know if there was a political angle to this, because Canada and the United States do not have state-run dental services, so the poor generally don't get dental care. And so by fluoridating the water, it was kind of a gesture towards universal dental care. I mean, was that sort of a political cover against people who might say we should give dental care to everybody?
Yeah, I think that was part of it, and part of the opposition to people in the United States who were against the socialized medicine were also on the other side. But I think that the motivations here for many people, many dentists, have been always sound, ethical. I think they really felt that it worked. They really felt that it was doing a benefit, especially to poor children. But unfortunately, now we are discovering that the last people that should be getting fluoride or swallowing fluoride are children from low-income families. Because if fluoride lowers IQ, and the evidence is now very strong that it does, the last people in our population that need a few more IQ points shaved off their brains are children from low incomes, because they've already got so many strikes against them.
Right.
Their living conditions, their schooling, their diet.
Right.
They're the last people that should be getting fluoride. So good intentions, but a tragic, possibly very tragic consequence, which only now we're beginning to find out. But I think wiser people would have recognized that once you know that fluoride was damaging the growing tooth cells and causing this condition called dental fluorosis, and we know that the first year is the most susceptible mm-hmm. year for that in the baby, they should have thought, well, why would fluoride only attack the teeth? It's a very known toxic substance. Why would it just consolidate its damage in the teeth and not, for example, damage the bones or the other developing tissues in the baby? And we did have very, very wise counsel from Mother Nature. We should have known this. Mother Nature did not put much fluoride in mother's breast milk. The level in milk is 0.004 parts per million. And what that means is that a bottle-fed baby in a fluoridated community is getting about 200, 250 times more fluoride than a breastfed baby, more fluoride than nature intended. So I think it's clear. There was no shortage of fluoride in evolution. The proponents will point out, it's in many water sources. It's certainly in the sea where life began. 1.4 parts per million. So there's no shortage for nature to draw
1.4 in the sea?
In the sea, yeah, on average.
Okay.
So there was no shortage for nature to draw upon, but nature did not put fluoride in any biological system. That not one single biological process, not one single enzyme, protein, or any other reaction in the body needs fluoride to perform.
Well, that's interesting.
We also know that fluoride can damage many of these systems. It can interfere with enzymes and G proteins and so on. So there's every reason for nature to have kept fluoride away from the developing baby. In fact, I say that mother's milk protects the baby from fluoride, and we are circumventing that protection by putting fluoride in the water. And it's amazing that medical personnel and health agencies in the fluoridated countries cannot get that message. They seem now more intent on protecting this policy for some reason than protecting the health of their communities.
Well, it's maybe not protecting the policy, it's protecting their exalted status as infallible.
Yes, but that's important. I think reputations are important, and I think they fear that if they admit they've made this huge mistake, let alone all the consequences, but they've made this mistake, it's going to erode the public's trust, and that could impact other public health practices, which they might be more concerned about than actually fluoridation. you know, you have to struggle, David, to come up with a rational explanation for irrational behavior.
Yes, yes.
You do, because it's irrational to continue fluoridation when you know it's topical. It's irrational to continue to force it on people who clearly don't want it. It's irrational to do something that most of the world has rejected.
Right.
It's irrational to continue to do that after the evidence is coming in of harm with no margin of safety. And that's the point, that it's they get by saying, well, show me the study that shows an effect of fluoridation at 0.7 parts per million, the level that we fluoridate water in Canada. Show me those studies. Well, first of all, wink, wink, they're not doing those studies.
Right.
Okay? And if you don't look, you don't find.
Right, right. That's an important principle.
And to conclude that the absence of study is the same as absence of harm is just trivial poppycock. But there is no question, and we started with the conversation, there is no question that fluoride damages health. None at all. Millions of people have had the health damaged by
right.
fluoride. The only question that has to be resolved is there an adequate margin of safety? Words that they hardly use by the promoters of fluoridation, hardly use those words, margin of safety, because that's where they're killed. Because the levels of harm, the doses which are causing harm, this completely inadequate margin of safety between those doses and the doses that people are going to get in a fluoridated community, especially if you add in the fact that you can't control those doses, that
yes.
people drink a lot of water, and people have conditions which make them more vulnerable,
well, we
and
shouldn't,
they're getting fluoride from other sources.
We shouldn't be talking about one part per million, because that sounds like that's a dosage. But that's not a dosage, and what you'd really need to talk about is, like, what is the dosage per kilogram
yeah.
to a child or an adult, and of course that would be all over the map,
yep.
which would mean that the margin of safety in the water would have to be huge in order to accommodate people who drink huge quantities of water on a daily
absolutely.
Basis.
And getting fluoride from other sources. The margin of safety, I mean, I've done a lot of risk assessment in my career, especially when I was fighting incinerators. I did literally review dozens of them. And it's a standard safety factor in risk assessment. It's called the intra-species safety factor or variation factor. You have to assume that there's at least a tenfold range of sensitivity
right.
to any toxic substance. So if you find harm at a particular dose, especially if it's in a small human study,
right.
when you're extrapolating to a dose which you have to use to protect the whole community, you divide by 10. You
right.
divide by 10. Now, as far as the IQ studies are concerned, the lowest level that has been found to lower IQ, and I visited the community where that occurred, is 1.26 parts per million. 1.26 parts per million.
Right.
IQ is being lowered in about 100 Chinese children. Now you've got to say, calculate the dose, okay?
Right.
And milligrams per day, and then divide by 10. And you can clearly see that nobody's being protected. The children are not being protected from lowering of IQ living
right.
in fluoridated communities.
But
and you're right, David, to stress this. Concentration is measured in milligrams per liter. That's
right.
what part per million is. Milligrams
right.
per liter. And dose is measured in two ways. In milligrams per day.
Right.
And if you're an adult, that's sufficient to look at milligrams per day.
Right.
But if you're talking about protecting the whole population, and which includes infants, then you've got to talk about milligrams per kilogram body weight
right.
per day.
Yes.
You can't assume that a baby is a tiny adult. It's not. It's much more vulnerable because of its small size. And so that is the safe reference dose, for example, for fluoride in the United States currently is 0.06 milligrams per kilogram body weight per day. And a bottle-fed infant, according to the National Research Council in the United States, is getting about 0.08 or 0.09 milligrams per kilogram per day, from bottle feeding.
With water, fluoridated water.
Bottle feeding with fluoridated water, they are getting over the safe reference dose.
So there's no 10 times, there's no 10 times safety margin.
No, absolutely not.
And with water fluoridation, you know, given that there's dramatic differences in how much water people drink, you'd probably have to have 100-to-1 safety margin to ensure that everybody got fluoride below the safety margin, which would basically mean you'd have unfluoridated water.
Yeah. Absolutely. If this was a pollutant that the EPA was newly discussing because they find it in some water supplies, for example, and they were looking at the studies that have been done, animal studies and human studies, there's no way that fluoridation would get out of the starting tracks. It just wouldn't.
Right.
And as you rightly said, they would probably need a safety factor of 100 to account for both the wide range of human sensitivity in a population and the wide range of doses.
Fluoridation kind of came under the cover of many public health initiatives. I don't know if they were the early 20th century, like adding vitamins to like breakfast cereal, to taking white flour and adding back some of the nutrients that had been taken out by making it white flour. There were a number of health initiatives, but generally they were adding in a nutrient that our body needed, and you can argue whether that's the right way to do it. But it's a good point that fluoride, having no use in the body, at best is a substitute for something that makes stronger teeth. It's not itself a natural teeth strengthener.
It's not a nutrient. It's not an essential nutrient. And still, spokespeople for fluoridation, for the promoters, still make that mistake. It's not a nutrient.
Right.
As I said before, there's not one single process in the body that needs fluoride. To demonstrate that a substance is a nutrient, you have to starve the animal of that nutrient in its diet, and then find a disease that results. And, tooth decay is not caused by lack of fluoride. It's caused by too much sugar, basically.
Right.
Poor hygiene, poor diet. It's not the fluoride that the kids lack in some cases. It's the calcium and magnesium, the phosphate, the vitamin D.
Right.
Those are genuine nutrients which we need for healthy development of healthy bones, healthy teeth, and so on. And plenty of sunlight in addition to all that. So it's not lack of fluoride.
And so there's another political problem here, because if you start to turn the focus on to sugar, then you're going up against the massive industrial food industry that produces chocolate bars and drinks with sugar, although, you know, now they're replacing that mostly with aspartame, but there's still huge quantities of sugar used in foodstuffs.
Absolutely, and I'm not connecting the dots here, but it is a fact that 1 year before the U.S. Public Health Service mysteriously endorsed fluoridation, and I say that was 1950, mysteriously endorsed fluoridation. I say it was mysterious because they didn't even wait for the trials to be completed. One of those trials, by the way, was in Canada, Brantford, Ontario. They didn't wait for the trials to be completed before the U.S. Public Health Service endorsed it. And more importantly, they didn't wait to see any health studies. There was practically no health studies available in 1950 when the U.S. Public Health Service endorsed fluoridation and incidentally triggered a whole list of endorsements from everybody in the pea soup, alphabet soup of organizations, the ADA, the AMA, the APHA, and so on and so on and so on. And people are still quoting these organizations as endorsing fluoridation, where many of them haven't done a speck of research on this subject. Many of them endorse fluoridation just because the Public Health Service said it was okay. Anyway, 1 year before all that nonsense, the sugar lobby in the United States, in their journal, it was called the Sugar Research Foundation, had a journal called The Sugar Molecule. And in that journal, they wrote, we need to find a way to reduce reduce tooth decay without reducing sugar consumption.
Right.
That was 49, 1 year before the endorsement. And then the sugar industry continued to put money into nutrition departments, even forming nutrition departments in famous universities like Harvard University, and encouraging professors to promote the sugar as a wonderful nutrient, that Coca-Cola was a nutritious drink. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, that was said by a professor from Harvard University called Fred Stair. Yeah, he said that Coca-Cola was a nutritious drink, and he also said the same thing about cookies and candies and everything else. Get your sugar, guys.
Right.
And at the same time, he was promoting fluoridation. He was the beginning of the vitriolic attacks on citizens who said anything against fluoridation, or any politician, any professor who came out against fluoridation could expect a withering attack from Dr. Fred Stair of Harvard University. He became the prototype. It's very uncomfortable business, David. I've been through this for
right.
18 years. To be a prominent opponent of fluoridation, because they're going to throw everything at you. They're going to accuse you of doing this to make money. They're going to accuse you of using junk science, of
right.
misrepresenting, lying, all kinds of things. And no academic wants those kind of charges thrown at them. And when they see that happening, they keep away from the debate. They don't read the literature.
Yes.
And that's exactly what the promoters want. They don't want people looking at the literature. They want instead people to focus on all these endorsements,
right.
The use of authority, not the use of science. And one of the things which I've noticed most about promoters of fluoridation in public, they seldom ever cite a scientific paper. What they do is to cite all these people that endorse fluoridation, all these organizations that endorse fluoridation, and we are meant to go, oh, how wonderful. If all those people support fluoridation, must be good. And then the other thing they do is to refer to these reviews, which are done by hand-picked panels.
Right.
They hand-pick these panels of experts who are known to be pro-fluoridation.
Right.
Enough of them on any panel to sway the final judgment. And that happened very clearly. Health Canada selected 6 people to review the literature on safety and effectiveness of fluoridation.
Right.
And of those 6 people that they selected, 4 were dentists known to be avidly pro-fluoridation, including
right.
Jay Kumar of the New York Department of Health, is a very, very well-known promoter of fluoridation. Stephen Levy, who's had millions of dollars of taxpayers' money financing his research, and of course he has to keep his nose clean whenever he gets the chance. He tells people that fluoridation is fine. Michael Levy from Canada, and Chris Clark from Canada. Now, you know, you can show how biased that was, and of course they came back with the absolutely self-fulfilling prophecy,
right.
Fluoridation, safe, effective, no problem. Now, the weight of evidence shows there's no evidence that the fluoride damages IQ, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Now, the obvious example of why, showing that this was biased from the start, that it was contrived, was they chose Jay Kumar to be on that panel, and Jay Kumar was on the National Research Council team, 12 scientists, who did an excellent job with the reviewing fluoride toxicity. But also on that panel was Dr. Hardy Limebach
right.
from the University of Toronto. So why did Health Canada select Jay Kumar over Hardy Limebach, who was on their doorstep?
Right.
And if they wanted to demonstrate to the world that they were being fair, that they were being objective, then they should have selected both. That would have been ideal. They would
right.
have selected a guy that was known to be against fluoridation, who was on this prestigious panel. I mean, they studied the issue for 3.5 years. And Jay Kumar, who's known to be pro-fluoridation, put them both on the panel. And you had a chance of legitimate discussion and analysis. But no, they didn't do that. They selected Jay Kumar, didn't use Hardy Limebach, when the report came out, it was clearly pro-fluoridation. And then Health Canada based its review, I think it was 2011, maybe 2012, yeah. Based upon that those expert panels. So the whole thing was rigged.
Right.
The whole thing is fraudulent. From Health Canada, that was fraud. That was rigged.
Right.
And that rigging is being paid for by the taxpayers.
Right, in two ways. We pay for it with our health as well as our money. I mean, it's hard to see how you could... fluoridation is such a divisive issue. I mean, there's not really a middle ground. You're either... are in favor of it or you're against it. So having a panel that had proponents and opponents, it's hard to see how that would come to an agreement. And of course, Health Canada wanted an agreement and they wanted it in a particular way. And so I guess it's only natural they stacked the panel. But I remember being on a panel on a different health issue and I had completely diverse views from everybody else, and I ended up getting thrown off the panel.
Yeah,
because they said we're never going to come to an agreement, and I said, well, yeah, you're gonna do something that's terribly wrong if you keep going, and just because there's a majority that doesn't mean what you're doing is right. So eventually, I got the chop.
You know, in circumstances like that, usually what happens is you get a minority report.
Okay,
and that can be helpful.
Yes, like even on a Supreme Court judgment, sometimes the better reports are the losing side, and the argument is so cogent that everybody knows that it was a political decision. And this
is especially relevant when you've got an establishment position. I mean, the establishment's position, as they make clear, all the medical organizations, all the official dental organizations support fluoridation. So, yeah, in that case, it's absolutely essential to have a minority report because you can predict that the medical establishment is going to come down on one side.
I don't think people really realize how hierarchical medicine is in general, and that's definitely true of dental medicine. And so that when you look for a consensus, all you're really doing is reporting what the people at the top are saying.
That's right.
And it just becomes an echo chamber, and then you have 100 people at the bottom saying, yeah, we support fluoride. And if you add them up, you say, well, 9 out of 10 dentists support water fluoridation. But that doesn't say anything. But it's a pretty good way to pull the wool over people's
public
eyes.
Relations. It's good for public relations. But there are two chains of command. I mean, I talk about them in the book. Mm. But two chains of command in the United States. You have the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, the Oral Health Division. Then then you have in each state a dental director who's usually, I think his salary is usually paid for by the CDC. So you've got that direct line of control. Remember, the CDC is part of the public health, part of the, it's a uniform branch of government when you talk about hierarchies.
Right.
You know, you have the Lieutenant General, this, that, the Surgeon General. Surgeon General. He's in charge, you know.
Right.
And so you've got the chain of command then from the Center of Disease and the federal government down to each state dental director. And then that filters down to local health agencies, health boards at the local level. So you've got that chain of command. And also with the Dental Association, at the top you have the American Dental Association, then you have the state dental associations, then you have the local dental associations. And at the bottom you have dentists and you have doctors. Now, what makes this pretty pernicious is that the fact that doctors and dentists only get one side of the fluoridation issue at dental and medical school. And when they've graduated, they're so busy they can't do research on every single issue.
Right.
And not many are doing research of the literature on fluoridation. So they're easy meat to go along with their authorities.
Right.
And the bureaucrats in the chain of command, they know that they don't challenge policy. Their job is not to question policy. The policy is determined at the center, and their job is to carry out policy. So you're back to Health Canada, going to Canada, you're back to Health Canada determines the policy, and the medical officers of health are there to carry out Health Canada's policy at the local level. And the unfortunate thing is that they are well respected and trusted often by the local councillors.
Right. And another misunderstanding, I think, amongst the general population is that doctors are confused with scientists. And in actual fact, doctors accumulate a lot of information that's believed by the people at the medical school to be scientifically valid, but they have very little ability to critically evaluate that. But they're seen by the general population as people who have this body of scientific knowledge, who understand it and would know if it was non-scientific. But
yeah,
that's not the truth.
This is a good point. Of course, there are many brilliant doctors, I'm sure, who have a very good handle on science and scientific literature. But to me, as a lay person, as far as medicine is concerned, I'm appalled by two things, the two very lacking in a doctor's training. One is a lack of training on nutrition and a lack of training on environmental toxicology, the toxicology of substances. So a lot of diseases are being treated as if there's something wrong with the body when there's probably something wrong with the diet.
Yes.
And there's something wrong with the pollutants that people are being exposed to. And this wastes a lot of time and a lot of money, and of course can be very dangerous, because you start having side effects. If you give a drug which is totally inappropriate, if it's a nutritional problem or an environmental pollution problem, and you start treating that with drugs, then you're going to get the side effects of those drugs, which could cause even more complications than the original complaint. So I think medical the doctor's training needs a huge overhaul to catch up with the problems of modern society, where our nutrients are being depleted from our foods, from our soil, and also we're getting more and more pollutants being bombarded on us. And fluoride fits right into that thing. Doctors do not recognize the symptoms of someone who's sensitive to fluoride.
Yes.
And governments are just not willing to even put that on a scientific level, when it's what you would expect. You would expect, if you know that a toxic substance has toxic effects at high levels, then you can predict that there are going to be some individuals in society who are going to experience those symptoms at very low levels.
Yes.
It's exactly what you expect, the normal distribution. So some people are going to be very, very resistant to a toxic substance. Other people are going to be very, very sensitive to it. And most people are going to be in between. But the moment it's been established that the substance has some toxic effects at high doses, then you can anticipate that some people are going to experience those effects at very low doses.
Right. And I think you can rely on the medical professionals. Basically, they're trained that disease is caused by pathogens or genes. And so if there is a mysterious disease that occurs, or there's chronic disease, they're going to go looking for a virus that causes this, or a gene or something like that. They rarely go looking for a toxic substance, which is both the part their education and part that nobody wants to rock the boat when it comes to pollutants.
Yeah.
And
I think of this as a chemistry professor, okay? So and in my career, I must have trained many pre-meds. Okay, so you would expect that a doctor would need organic chemistry, because that's the chemistry, and then biochemistry, and then physiology, where the chemistry, the biochemistry is taking place. And then you would expect two different courses. One course which says, these are the substances that every human being should have in their diet to make all this feasible, make it happen smoothly. And by the way, this other course, these are the substances, if you're inadvertently exposed to them, that can mess up this system. That, to me, is a logical menu of studies that doctors should have. And the last two are missing, the a course on nutrition, not just one or two lessons, but a whole course on nutrition and a whole course on environmental chemistry.
Yes.
And toxicology.
I agree. I think when people think about it, they know that doctors' education is deficient in these ways. We've been talking for almost an hour. It doesn't seem like it's been that long, but we have. So I would like to ask you if you have any last points, to important things that you haven't got out yet in our discussion.
Well, I suggest if people who want more science should get our book. Or get it from the library, order it from the library.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in this to make money, by
right.
the way. All the proceeds go to the Thyroid Action Network. They should have a look at our website. We have more health data, more data on fluoride's potential harm than all the health agencies put together on a website. So,
and what is the website?
It's fluoridealert.org. Make sure you spell fluoride, F-L-U, think of flu.
Right.
Not F-L-O. Many people make that spelling mistake.
Okay.
Fluoridealert.org. If you're scientifically inclined, you will love it if you click on the researchers button in the top right.
Right.
Top right, and you'll get a link to the health database. And you can
okay.
search by tissue, fluoride in the brain, fluoride in the bone, fluoride
okay.
in the kidney, and so on. And also, if you're not scientifically inclined and want an easier education, then click on... fan videos, fan TV,
that's right.
also at the top bar, and you get a lot of videotapes. And I really recommend people watch their professional perspectives on water fluoridation, where 15 scientists, including Hardy Lineback from Canada, discuss reasons why. It's only 28 minutes.
Okay.
10 reasons why you shouldn't fluoridate. My son has done another video, it's only 20 minutes long, called the 10 Fluoride Facts. And that's backed up with a document, which you can also download. So lots of really good stuff on our webpage, fluoridealert.org.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being with me today. And I'm sure that my audience is going to find this very interesting. And I guess the struggle continues. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you, David, very much indeed.